We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Tuesday, February 11th, and things are just trucking along with Donald Trump's confirmations. And so the Senate late yesterday advanced Tulsi Gabbard out of committee. And so that set up the 30-hour debate clock, after which she will likely get a vote. And I think that she will end up getting confirmed. Susan Collins, of course, who's one of those that, unfortunately, because of the composition of the Senate and the very slim majority that Republicans have with the tie-breaking vote, Vance, and the fact they can only lose three senators, she at least came out and said that she will support Tulsi, and also, I believe, RFK Jr., but he will probably be the last to ultimately be confirmed as probably the most contentious. It's kind of like the Senate is mirroring the U.S. Supreme Court, where they know what they're going to do, but they wait until the very end of term, like the last day possible, to release their most controversial opinions. It kind of feels like that's what the Senate is doing with confirmations. But let's welcome in Ryan Fournier, who is the founder of Students for Trump, and get his perspective. So, Ryan, I mean, you know, in all reality, we're only 3 weeks into the second term of Trump. I mean, this is overall pretty fast, actually.
It's almost like you wake up every single day and you're being fed with like a fire hydrant, with just so many like wins. I mean, just historic amounts of success within such a short period of time. You know, there's so many things that have happened in this period. I can't even imagine how it's going to look after the first 100 days. I feel like we're going to have so much to talk about at that point. We're not even going to know what to talk about. But no, it's good. It's good to hear from you. Good to talk.
Yeah, absolutely. And you too. And I know this is the first time that we've talked on air since the inauguration. And so, you know, overall with these confirmation hearings and those who have already been confirmed, let's talk about the giant upgrades from Merrick Garland to Pam Bondi. And then, of course, from Buttigieg, you know, the chest feeder Mayor Pete to Sean Duffy, who actually is on the ground places and, you know, is very present as the transportation secretary. I think overall, even if some may say, you know, these some particular nominees weren't necessarily their first choice, I think we can all agree that every single pick from Trump is a massive upgrade.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And Sean Duffy, he was just down here yesterday, I believe, in Western North Carolina, showing off the destruction of the Blue Ridge Parkway, which is, you know, major, you know, connection route between Tennessee and North Carolina, big traffic tourism route, import-export route. So that's a big, big issue. And they're saying that it's going to take, you know, probably up to 2 or 3 years and, you know, $1 billion+ to restore that. So I'm glad that he's on the ground and he's giving that information out to people so we know what to expect. We know how much it's going to cost. And he's present, which I never saw Pete Buttigieg do in his entire time as a transportation secretary. Now, with Pam Bondi, she is already coming in. She's already getting rid of these attorneys, you know, sort of some of these prosecutors in the DOJ who've been causing problems, causing issues, especially some of the people from Jack Smith's team who decided not to leave, from what I've heard. But then I don't know if you saw her on Fox News the other day. She gave an interview, and she is very smart and very, you know, wise with what she says. But you can tell that she has, like, righteous indignation. Like, she's mad. she's upset. She knows that she's tasked with a very important job to clean up a department that has become so riddled with corruption, but she's getting it done, and she's gotten a lot done already. So I'm very optimistic about this, and, you know, especially when it comes to Tulsi, Cash, and RFK, this is an all-star cabinet of outsiders who know what to do and know how to get things done.
Yes, so well said. I'm speaking with Ryan Fournier, who is the founder of Students for Trump. You can follow him on X and other social media. And Ryan, you know, the left's pushback to this, I think, is, for one, hilarious, because if you look at Biden's cabinet picks, clearly a lot of them were optics over actual merit. I mean, you have the nuclear scientist who's dressing like a woman and ends up stealing women's clothing and baggage from, I think it was Dulles Airport. I mean, just crazy, like Babylon Bee headline stuff. You have Admiral Rachel Levine, who, of course, is a man in a dress. You have, you know, so many others that we could go through. I mean, Mayor Pete, all of these people who clearly, just because of their identity and in some instances, sexual orientation, I mean, even Karine Jean-Pierre, you know, the press secretary, was lauded as, like, you know, the first openly LGBT press secretary because apparently she thinks she can be married to a woman. I mean, you know, just utter nonsense, and we see the sheer incompetence. And yet the left's pushback to all of this is to say that Trump's nominees are not worthy of their positions, because you have somebody like Pete Hegseth, who they claim, you know, is only a Fox News host. And they tried during his confirmation hearing to utterly ignore all of his military service. I mean, it's right. Utterly preposterous. I think the Democrat Party has nowhere to go with any of this.
No. Well, I mean, they really don't have a leg left to stand on. I mean, you saw what happened with the primary. You saw what happened with Joe, the swap with Kamala. They know they messed up. They know they're, you know, in a certain position right now. And, you know, when we first announced these nominees, when the Republican senators were coming out, I thought it was incredible, like saying, oh, we're going to oppose this, we're going to oppose this. And now it has shifted in such a way, and it surprised me, to where you have almost all senators coming to agreement now. And, of course, you know, there were conversations. I know J.D. Vance was involved with that, a lot of backdoor conversations with senators, giving assurances on sort of their concerns and whatnot. And so J.D. killed it. You know, he nailed that. So to see it coming together, like in unity, to support Trump's candidates, to, you know, his nominees, because he does have the mandate, that's really impressive to me. That's really a testament to people coming together in the party and uniting, because they know the Democrats aren't anywhere near that right now.
Yeah, that is such a great point. And I think that there definitely is more unity among conservatives by and large. And, you know, even Republicans, libertarians, you know, a little more, even like moderate independents. I mean, everybody who clearly resoundingly voted for Trump, voted for the trifecta, voted on the state and local level. I mean, the Democrat Party is becoming even more irrelevant because of their worldview and the sheer disaster of the implications of their policy. And I think the American people so clearly saw that over the last 4 years of Joe Biden and everything that happened with the COVID narrative and just all of that. And so, you know, kind of projecting forward, Ryan Fournier, my special guest this morning, when we're looking at the Trump mandate, already people are talking about the midterms and next year, you know, 2026. Do you think the mandate carries over, and what does the Republican Party and conservatives have to do in order to get across that finish line to make sure that, you know, we have 4 years of good policy and a trifecta in Washington?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a mandate only sticks if you stick to what you promised. Right. So and Trump has already accomplished so much in these first 3 weeks. Some of these big promises, you know, no tax on tips. I mean, there's a laundry list. I'd be here for a couple minutes. But after 100, you know, if he pulls this off this, you know, the first year, we have all this success and we're going into the second year and the approvals are still good, I think that mandate does carry down. But I also experienced, you know, I got on the TikTok recently since, you know, they got at risk of being banned, and I came across their live spaces, and there's a lot of conservatives in there. People of all walks of life, Black Americans, Asian Americans, who are in there supporting Trump. And one of the common things that I've seen is that, you know, some people come in there and they say they voted for Kamala and they regret that because they see so much happening in 3 weeks that's already changing the country in such a pivotal way, you know, towards American success, the golden era again. And I hear that from so many people who even voted for Kamala or may have voted for Joe Biden in the past and maybe voted Trump this time. It's all different, but there's definitely a turn here. And if that momentum sticks, especially a year, year and a half in, then I'm not worried about the midterms. But we also have to make sure that going into this as a party, we are working together to help find the right candidates to run in these areas or to run against, you know, a Democrat candidate or whatever. You know, we need to find the right people. That's kind of up to the movement to pick that. But
and I think we may have lost a sound a little bit for Ryan Fournier, but as we're you're back.
I'm still here. I was trying to land my plane anyway.
All right, go ahead.
it's really going to be up to us to, you know, find these candidates because I know there's always somebody that comes out of nowhere and, you know, they want to run and, you know, they may not have, you know, the skill set or the resources, but if they're a good person and they know the policy, then it's up to us to support them, right? So we have to put the right people up in front and hopefully get them through the primary and win the general.
Yeah, and that's a great point in terms of the primaries because, you know, often when we look at some of these people, I mean, like a Susan Collins, for example, who it's just so frustrating to see, you know, she and Lisa Murkowski and all that are maybe reluctantly supporting Trump and, oh, they're coming around on their opinions. Or we see people like Dan Crenshaw or Lindsey Graham or, you know, a whole host of others that aren't necessarily the best representatives in the House and the Senate of the conservative movement. And we wonder why they keep getting reelected. Well, it's often because they have so much name recognition and support that it's just a primary blowout. And so looking ahead to the primaries, which I think is a critical battleground, what in particular is, you know, Students for Trump or TPUSA or, you know, some of these other organizations? I know that, you know, you're very well connected in a lot of these different movements. What are we looking at in terms of possibly getting some better conservatives in for the primary?
Yeah, I'm not sure what Turning Point's doing, but I know they're going to be mobilized with Turning Point Action for sure. And they're probably going to be hitting states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Florida, to really, you know, hit some of these districts where we have a winning chance to gain some more seats. Right now, we're on the planning board right now for SFT to figure out what we're going to do with Students for Trump for the primaries, but we're probably going to do something similar. I really want to team up with Scott Pressler, who did a phenomenal job in Pennsylvania, flipping those counties and, you know, helping us win that state. Really want to team up with him because he's going to be a big game changer this cycle around with the arsenal of people he's built up, of volunteers, fundraising efforts. And they go out there and they get the job done. They door knock, they phone bank, and they register voters and they get the ballot. So they're killing it. So if we can all team up together and as a united front going into this, I think that we're going to have huge electoral victories.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ryan, thanks so much for your perspective. And I totally agree. And just for our listeners as well, you know, with Scott Pressler, there's been a lot of commentary and, you know, a little bit of drama surrounding his personal life. I mean, he's an open homosexual. And I posted this on X. I said, you can disagree with the personal morality or theology of an individual while recognizing the good they are doing. I am a Christian, so of course I disagree with Scott Pressler's homosexuality. I also applaud that he is helping win more conservative races, which ultimately helps conservative Christian policy. Likewise, I disagree with Paula White's theology and calling herself a pastor. I applaud that she is helping advance religious freedom, which ultimately helps conservative Christian policy. I am not recommending Scott for authority in the church, nor attending Paula's church, but I am willing to work with them on a common cause in civil society, the same way I'm willing to work with feminists on on women's sports and RFK on MAHA. I would even work with Democrats if they were championing the right things in civil society. Working with someone in a coalition on an issue or even voting for them is not an endorsement of their entire worldview. Although I disagree theologically with Mike Lee, LDS, Tulsi's a Hindu, Harmeet, who's a Sikh, even DeSantis, who's a Roman Catholic, no one in the Protestant faith is suggesting we stop working with them in civil government. The civil government is not the church. Now, do I want the civil government to select and prefer solid theological Christians as our leaders? Absolutely. And I will consistently object to anything that appears to be endorsement of sin or false theology or bad policy in broader conservatism or from the Republican Party. I think we fail to keep the proper balance of coalition building and issues and standing firmly on truth if we approach our colleagues in civil society with an affirm everything they believe or ban them from MAGA attitude. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And I ended that last segment reading a response that I had posted on social media, actually on all of my platforms, in response to a lot of different opinions out there that on Scott Pressler, who has done a lot for the conservative movement and Republicans, and also Paula White being installed in the White House faith office. Of course, she was there during Trump's first term when I was working for Trump as part of also the Evangelicals for Trump coalition. I worked with Paula White, and that's, you know, controversial to some Christians because, of course, I disagree with her theology and the fact that she calls herself a pastor. But in terms of a coalition on policy issues, the reason that I put this out on social media was to respond to, I think, getting off on both sides, where people who say, well, if you want to champion certain issues and coalitions, then you have to affirm what you disagree with about the theology or personal life, like Scott Pressler or others, in order to work with them in a coalition. That's false. You don't have to affirm that to work with them on what you do agree with. But then on the other hand, some people would say that because you disagree with a person's theology or their lifestyle choices or, you know, anything else about them, then you can't work with them in a coalition on issues. And we've seen the falsity of that as well in working with even feminists on women's sports issues, or even sometimes Democrats, and working with them across the aisle on issues that really shouldn't be partisan. Working with someone in a coalition is not an endorsement of everything else that they stand for or everything that they stand for in their personal life. So I think we need to come back to a biblical worldview on this. And I want to welcome in Mike Donnelly, who's a constitutional law professor, also a very dear friend and a solid Christian. And he and I were actually talking about this very topic. So, Mike, I wanted to, before we get into the other issue, I wanted to just get your take as a Christian on that whole controversy and concept of co-belligerence.
Aja, good morning. Great to be with you and your amazing audience. Hope everyone's having a wonderful day today. You know, over my 20 plus years of working in public policy, and before that, you know, running a company and serving in the military, you don't always get to choose your bedfellows, right? You've got to work with people who you may disagree with on a lot of different issues. But you know what? When you're in the foxhole and you're pointing your weapons at the enemy, you know who the enemy is. And it doesn't really matter who's in the foxhole with you. Now, don't take that too far, because I'm not trying to advocate for the crazy policies that our Department of Defense has been promulgating over the last 8 years or so. But at the end of the day, if you want to save this country, we've got to work with people of all kinds. And so I've done that. I've done that all around the world, as I've traveled to advocate for homeschooling freedom. You've got to work with people when you can find common ground. And, you know, there may be times when a person's character is to the point where you can't, because the association is just not acceptable. But I think that's a case-by-case analysis and not just sort of a generalization that you can make, as you pointed out earlier.
Yeah, and I think it also depends on context. So, for example, if this were a Christian conference, or something that was advocating a parachurch kind of, ministry purpose, then there may be a different setting and a different view as to the association as a Christian versus, say, public policy, where you can get people in, all world views of life. I mean, even looking at our founders, they didn't all agree on everything, certainly not even theology, but they had common ground in unanimously declaring correctly that our rights come from God, our creator, and the purpose of government is to preserve and protect those rights. Now, could we have a debate on, whether their theology was exactly correct and precise, or how we disagree with, some of the things that Jefferson believed? I mean, of course, but I think this is where we have to understand that there are two distinct institutions, three actually, but for our purposes, that God ordained. Civil government and church government are very different jurisdictional spheres and institutions, and we have to be careful that we don't just say, well, because we can work with people in the civil government realm, we can associate with them in church, or just because we disagree with them on matters that are very important theologically, that means we can't work with them in the civil sector.
I think that's very fair, Jen. And I think, as believers, what should also motivate us is, our duty to share the gospel with people. And, we're all a bunch of sinners saved by the grace of God. And, God brings us into association with people. You mentioned Scott Pressler and other people like that. And, God brings Christians into contact with people who are in openly rebelling against God's plan for, human sexuality or relationships or, marriage or what have you. And, that's an opportunity that we have when we encounter people, is to develop a relationship, not necessarily a friendship, right? But a relationship where we may have the opportunity to share the gospel with people like that. And I think that's really important too.
Yeah, so well said. Well, before we run out of time, and Mike Donnelly, I really appreciate it. I know you're planning on commenting on that topic, but I knew you would be precision and biblical on it. Yeah. So, live radio, isn't it fun, guys, when, you invite guests on? And I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me, so turnabout is fair play. But
I never did it to you, though, Jenna, because right? I haven't hosted any radio shows.
Yeah, well, one of those days I'll come on as a guest when I invite you to guest host, and, you can have at it, and that'll be
fun. That sounds
good.
I like it. I'm going to hold okay. you to that.
Yeah, absolutely, he will. And for those listening, Mike and I go way, way back, so I know he'll hold me to that. But I want to get your comments also on Trump's executive orders, the power of the executive with Article 2, and the fact that some of these ridiculous judges are going outside of the bounds of the Constitution, and they are basically saying that it's unconstitutional for Trump to run his own executive branch. And this is what Stephen Miller said about unelected bureaucrats running the country in terms of the Treasury and that injunction that a federal judge put on it, which is so ridiculous. This is what he had to say Monday on Fox.
That ruling is an assault on the very idea of democracy itself. What we continue to see here is the idea that rogue bureaucrats who are elected by no one, who answer to no one, this unelected shadow force that is running our government and running our country.
So, Mike, I think Stephen Miller is spot on. And this is insane when you think about the judiciary basically gatekeeping the executive from simply doing his job.
I really like Stephen Miller. I've really been impressed as I've watched him, and I appreciate the work he's doing. And he's right. You know, Article III judges have no authority to tell the executive branch how to run the executive branch, period. Now, you know, if there was a congressional law that required certain things, we can get into the weeds and look at it. But what I'm seeing right now are Democrat-appointed judges who are just reacting and asserting political authority, not judicial authority. The one that just drives me crazy is this one out of, I think it was New York, where this Obama-appointed judge issued an ex parte order prohibiting Treasury people from outside the Treasury or special appointed government employees and DOGE staff from accessing Treasury records, which is absurd. The President of the United States is the chief executive. He runs the executive branch. Scott Bessent is the Treasury Secretary, and he gets to decide who accesses Treasury records. And no judge anywhere gets to say otherwise. I hope that the Trump administration will just ignore them. I've been seeing some news stories where the judge is saying, hey, the Trump administration isn't following my order. Yeah, your order is unconstitutional. And eventually, you know, if it gets appealed up to the Supreme Court, will be adjudicated as such. You know, I really think that Donald Trump had a life-defining moment when that bullet missed him. Mm-hmm. And he's alive because of God's miraculous intervention, in my opinion. And he realizes his time is short and he has got a very narrow window in which to do really big things to help save our country. And so I'm excited about what I'm seeing him do with all of his executive orders and what he has empowered the DOGE team to do by exposing the fraud and the abuse and the corruption that we all knew existed and now is on full display. So I hope that the Trump administration will just continue on, do what they think is right. And, you know, eventually when it reaches the Supreme Court, we'll see what's right.
Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. And I wish that the resolution to this wasn't even waiting until the Supreme Court overturned this, which they should. And I have hope, at least because of the conservative coalition, perhaps, you know, on the Supreme Court, that they'll do that, because you're absolutely right that they're answering a policy question. This judge is answering the policy question, not the constitutional question. The constitutional question is, can the executive do this? Do they have the power, whether or not anybody agrees with it or not? And if the answer to that is yes, they can, then the legal question ends there. But they're answering the should question of whether or not this is a good idea in this judge's framework or mindset. That's a policy and political question that they have absolutely no authority over. So I wish that when judges go out so far outside of Article 3 actual authority and their own subject matter jurisdiction, that the House would impeach them. And I know that, you know, the Senate, likely we're not going to get to the 2/3 majority actually needed to remove them. But if judges actually had to come in and have a trial and defend some of these things, maybe they would think differently. Do you think that we may potentially see the political will to actually use the check and balance on the judiciary that's given by our founders to the House?
If the President of the United States can be impeached for a phone call, I don't see why judges can't be impeached for ex parte orders that are totally outside the bounds of the Article III case and controversy authority that they have. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Jim Jordan's a judiciary chair. I mean, anyone can file articles of impeachment. You know, is there a representative out there who's willing to file articles of impeachment against this judge in New York? I mean, when a judge has gone so far outside the bounds of their Article III authority, such that it is to the detriment of justice, right, and the public good. And those are words that the House Judiciary Committee's report accused Nixon of. Okay, they said his actions were to the detriment of justice, right, and the public good, alleging violations of his constitutional duty to ensure the faithful execution of the laws. Well, if a judge is doing the same thing, I think that's good enough to impeach. And so what I've been saying on Twitter is, or X, ignore impeach. Ignore these judges who are just political hacks and the House should impeach them. And you're right, the Senate won't convict her because there aren't two-thirds who would do it. But it'll send a message. And a few of those, maybe the judges will get the message.
Yeah, and impeachment of federal judges, just so that everyone is aware, it's rare, but it actually has occurred. And as of 2024, in our nation's history, only 15 federal judges have been impeached, and I think about 8 were convicted and removed by the Senate. So, I mean, unlike the presidency, that no president who's been impeached has actually been convicted and removed, 8 federal judges have been. So, I mean, there is clear precedent. This is exactly why the founders gave the power of impeachment, to remove people, not for political partisan purposes, but if they're actually going outside the scope of their legitimate authority. So the House, in my view, needs to do that. But the other thing that you mentioned, Mike Donnelly, who is a constitutional law professor, you can follow him at Donnelly Speaks on X. I'd encourage you to do that. You mentioned, you know, ignore. And this is something that is being debated widely on social media right now. When it's so clear that it's an unconstitutional order, the DOJ and the Trump administration is fighting back against this. But in the meantime, what legal grounding do they have to just say, this is unconstitutional, you're binding the executive when you don't have the power to do that, so we're just going to ignore you until the court rules in our favor?
I think the president of the United States has the authority to interpret the Constitution. Now, the Supreme Court, you know, has said, no, we get to say what the Constitution says. I think it's gone a little bit too far. And I think, you know, that would be an interesting issue to try to push up to the Supreme Court of the United States, to get them to clarify some of their holdings that they've had over the last 30 years. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is now off the court, is responsible for some of those, in particular a case called Bernie v. Flores back in, I think it was 1997, regarding the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, where, you know, the Justice Kennedy and 4 other justices said, no, the Supreme Court is the final arbiter as to what the Constitution says. I don't think that's right. I think that other branches of government have the authority and a duty and obligation to interpret the Constitution. And so in this case, I think the president can look at a clearly unconstitutional order. Just like in the Army, when I was in the Army, I had an obligation to interpret orders and assess whether an order was a lawful order. Just like in this case, I think the president can assess the judge's ex parte order in particular, this one out of New York, and there's a few other ones, and determine whether he believes it's unconstitutional, and if it clearly is, he should ignore it.
And, you know, that is a great interpretation. And I think there are clear examples of, as you just mentioned, but also, I mean, the whole idea of Chevron deference that has now gotten overturned by the Supreme Court, but the whole idea that the executive agencies could interpret congressional rules and the law in their own way, and the court even had to give deference to their interpretation. I mean, that's just the law that Congress passes. This isn't ultimately the Constitution. And when all executive authority is given to the president by virtue of Article 2, it makes sense that he would have to interpret it to understand what his limitations are. And so you have to have this balance. Otherwise, the judiciary becomes, as we've seen it, becomes the most powerful branch of government when it was clearly never intended to be.
Well, that's absolutely right. You know, it's one of my favorite topics, you know, Federalist 15. I've said that on your show before. I think everybody needs to read Federalist 15 because in that paper, in the Anti-Federalist Paper 15, you know, the founder who wrote that predicted what we're seeing now. And, you know, but I'm encouraged because we're peeling that back. The repeal of Chevron was a pushback against the executive branch, right? And we needed that. We should not be just the court should not be so blindly deferring to the executive branch. At the same time, we cannot have the courts becoming a veto or a check of this magnitude. Yes, it's supposed to be a check, but not of this magnitude on every action of the executive, especially of the president and of cabinet secretaries, especially when they're doing what they were elected to do by a majority of the American people, and when what they're doing is rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse. And a judge who is standing in the way of that, well, you kind of wonder.
Yeah, well said. And, you know, this is also a judge standing in the way of the executive running their own agency. I mean, we're not even talking about some kind of non-delegation to another branch, or, you know, things that are clearly in the Constitution. I mean, these agencies are creations of the executive, some of them even unconstitutional wholly. In fact, I would argue most are unconstitutional. And so to think that then a federal judge can bind the executive into not getting rid of waste in an unconstitutional agency to begin with is just mind-bogglingly stupid. And how the administrative state has become so big, even through the judiciary and its own order. So I hope that we succeed and that the current composition of the Supreme Court, like you said, Mike Donnelly, will ultimately rule in favor of the law and the Constitution. We'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we're continuing to discuss all of the different ways that the Trump administration and, frankly, the judiciary and also Congress have the opportunity over the next 4 years to really roll back a lot of this big bureaucracy that has just grown exponentially over the last, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. How do we kind of do that comprehensively? We're seeing the plan that's being implemented by Team Trump. I think they've been very strategic. They have had a lot of precision, and they are targeting so many different areas simultaneously that the media can't even keep up. And there is an overall roadmap for restoring freedom in America that's at Advancing American Freedom. You can find it at advancingamericanfreedom.com, and it's titled The Freedom Agenda. And Paul Teller, who is the executive vice president for Advancing American Freedom, joins me now. And he's also going to join me on the On Demand podcast on Friday. So this is kind of just a little bit of a preview about the deep dive that we're going to do into some of these areas of policy and what Trump and the Republican trifecta can actually do. So, Paul, good morning, and kind of give us an overall taste of this freedom agenda.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it. Always great to be with you. And yeah, and thanks for queuing it up just that way. I mean, I think what we've been trying to do with the freedom agenda is, as you described it perfectly, it create a roadmap to restoring freedom in America. And you may say, like, well, what's the big deal? Well, think about how much freedom we've lost just over the last 4 years under Biden and Harris. And so we basically got together a variety of different voices in the conservative movement across the spectrum. In other words, it wasn't all people that kind of agreed with each other. Some we affirmatively asked for their ideas, and some I was just kind of passively listening as I would meet with them, talk to them, go to meetings, and we just basically crowdsourced all kinds of ideas for how do you restore freedom, basically in three buckets: American culture, American opportunity, American leadership, you know, which are maybe modern words for, you know, social conservatism, economic conservatism, national security conservatism. But we just thought we'd update the terminology there. And I hope your listeners will go to it. Like you said, advancingamericanfreedom.com. It just, you know, it doesn't give like super hyper detailed things because we thought that's for another time, but it just gives sort of medium to high level ways that you could recede government out of your life, out of the lives of everyday Americans, and give people more of their own choices, more of their own control.
And I love this, Paul Teller, because you're absolutely right that a lot of this is about removing bad policy, removing intrusion of government into everyday American lives, you know, removing things like how high income tax is. I mean, just, you know, removing all of this. And so often, even Republicans are champions of adding more of the red tape or adding more rules or laws or regulations or this kind of thing. But I think the real opportunity, if we can just encapsulate it into one idea, is to get rid of as much as we possibly can in the next 4 years. And that, I think, is why DOGE has been so significant and such a focal point already of the Trump administration and what they've been able to map of some of this just astronomically outrageous spending.
Yeah. And again, you nailed it right on the head. It's perfect, because what's so exciting about the DOGE and just the overall, you know, Office of Management and Budget, OMB under Russ Vought, and just other folks there in the White House, the Trump inner circle, what's so exciting is that they're finally doing what Republicans have been saying they've wanted to do for decades. You know, I've been privileged to be working in national politics for 30-something years, And think about it, right? All the talking points on the right are always about cut government, cut regulation, cut waste, and it never happens. In fact, a lot of times it's the exact opposite. If you unfortunately go back and look at spending increased trends, sometimes they're worse under Republican control than under Democratic control. It's unbelievable. So point being, here we have Republicans finally in office, in power, saying we're going to do what we said we've wanted to do for the last three-plus decades and actually start cutting waste, start cutting government, and not trimming around the edges either, right? Because that's sometimes what Republicans have done. You know, here's a $10 billion agency. I'll cut $50 million out of it. Well, look, every cut helps, but, like, that's still just kind of trimming the weeds. DOGE is saying, no, we are ripping the weeds out. We are putting fertilizer down so the weeds never grow back, and we are going to grow only the most green, beautiful grass that needs to grow. So it's just, it's really inspiring, really fantastic, and we've been working with them already just with different spending cut ideas and different ways they can go about it. So it's just really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, to use your analogy, Paul Teller, I mean, we don't just want, you know, the weeds to look prettier and the spending to just look a little nicer on the outside. I mean, we want to destroy it completely and uproot it completely. And this is why it is so exciting to have kind of this projection already just 3 weeks in into the next 4 years. And, you know, as you mentioned, you've been around national politics for a significant amount of time through, you know, a lot of different presidential administrations, including Republicans and Democrats. But I think there's also a significant distinction and difference in just the mindset and the approach and the strategy between Trump first term and Trump 2.0. What do you see as the distinction in terms of this specific agenda?
Great point also. You're making great points today. I love everything you're saying. there's a distinct difference between the two. And again, I was privileged to be one of the four-year participants in the first Trump administration, January 2017 to January 2021. Great honor. But yes, I think the one thing we were lacking in those 4 years was this culture in the White House and even our supportive allies, this culture of not only just spending cuts, but like we were saying, ripping the weeds out, total elimination of programs, of agencies, of offices. And not, again, just for the fun of it or just because we don't like the leader of one agency, but because we want to bring government back, remove it from the lives of people. We want it to have less power, less control in people's lives. And that culture does exist in the current Trump-Vance administration, where it's just, you know, they're just saying government has gotten too big, too intrusive, it takes too much of your money, and any solution that it happens to have, it always hurts the American people, meaning it spends more money, it borrows more money, it taxes, it takes more out of your pockets. They finally said that needs to stop. We're reversing it. We're not trimming around the edges. We're going to rip things out from the roots. And it's just super inspiring. Looking forward to, you know, so much more.
Absolutely. And I'm speaking with Paul Teller, who's the Executive Vice President of Advancing American Freedom. And you can find this whole agenda at advancingamericanfreedom.com and /freedom-agenda. But, you know, you can also click on any of those tabs there. And you can also follow Paul. He is actually on X now, at P. Teller. I'd encourage you to do that. I know, finally. We've all been waiting, you know. So some longer than others. But you know, looking at this whole agenda here and the three categories, and I know we'll go a little deeper on Friday. So for listeners, go to AFR.net. You can click on the tab for podcasts and then click on demand. And this episode with Paul Teller is going to drop on Friday. And so looking forward to that. But these three buckets of American culture, American opportunity, and American leadership, I think even just those titles kind of resonate with this this generation, or maybe the new MAGA movement or the America First movement, however you want to describe it. But interestingly, you know, I think culture has been one of the focal points of MAGA overall, even with just the memeability of Trump, his ability to speak so frankly to the American people. I mean, him being on X and Twitter, which in his first term, that was so unprecedented for a president to just speak directly to the American people. What do you see as a conservative and also Christian that really we have an opportunity for in the culture today?
Well, you're exactly right. And it's not a coincidence that we led in the freedom agenda with culture. That's the first section. That was deliberate. We thought about, like, you know, what really is top of mind? What is driving American politics today? And sure, of course, the economic issues will always be important. That's a constant. But it seems like where the heart is these days of politics, of the conservative movement, is in the culture realm, whether it's, you know, keeping men out of women's sports, whether it's just allowing, you know, a baker to say, I don't want to bake that cake because it offends who that cake is, you know, it offends me who that cake is going to. Things like that, basic kind of cultural things, parental control of education, even just the ability to apply for a job and know that, like, the other guy waiting in line to apply for the same job is not an illegal immigrant who just cut the line to come into America and is now competing with you when he or she has no right to even be in America. So all these things just are where the heart and soul are of politics, of the conservative movement. So we led with that. We dug in on it. I think that many studies have shown that's really why Trump advance won, was on the cultural issues were huge and really pulling maybe moderates and even some left leaners over to vote Republican, vote for Trump and even other Republicans up and down the ballot because of those cultural issues that they just in their gut know are wrong. They've been going wrong the last four years, that kind of thing, the gender transitions of kids, all these things. And so we're excited that the current administration has already dug in on it. Republicans in Congress are digging in on it. And, you know, conservative friends like us on the outside are pushing and helping as much as we can. So just look forward to more successes there.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that just this overreach from the left and how much their nonsensical policy and how clearly it is antithetical to just basic common sense. I mean, we as Christians would say it's antithetical to a biblical worldview, to principles of freedom, all of these things. But you don't even need to be a Christian to just know that it offends the basic notions of the reality to which we're all presented. I mean, we all know that men are men and women are women and you can't change your gender. I mean, it's so basic. Yeah. That it's absurd that the left has been trying to push this. And I think that, like they always do, they overplayed their hand. But this was incremental for them. And, you know, as you very well know, Paul Teller, I mean, this is something, even going back and watching the old show, The West Wing, which is kind of one of my favorites, actually, as liberal kind of
classic.
As it is. Yeah, but it's very interesting to see back in, like, the 90s when the show came out, how much they were talking about advancing the LGBTQ agenda, but in very, very subtle terms. And it was just kind of, you know, at its inception and stuff. And they were planting the seeds in that show that would then blossom, of course, into the absurdity that it is today. And so do you think we have an opportunity to just do the whole bulldozing in the culture, or are we going to have to do this a little bit more incrementally?
That's a good point. And I think maybe the jury is still out on exactly that, you know, on the exact answer. But I think what we probably could all agree on is for some of these things that are so extreme, I don't know if we have time to do incrementalism, right? When you're talking about, you know, hormones and surgeries on like 8-year-olds who are just suddenly thinking they're maybe the other gender just because, like, you know, a girl is a little bit of a tomboy, or, you know, guy happens to like, you know, on a soft rock or something, you know, and to do these horrible, like, mostly irreversible things to children, I don't know that we have time to be slow and methodical. I think we may just have to rip the Band-Aid off and take big, bold steps and throw entire programs and agencies out. And that's what you're seeing with the Trump administration, which again is inspiring, because in the past Republicans would say, let's have a commission, let's study it, let's think about it, let's work on it. And sometimes there just is no time. We just need to exit. We need to stop. We need to eradicate, you know, right out of the gate. By the way, one other point I want to make, Jenna, real quick, on the freedom agenda, when your listeners are going to it, you know, again, advancingamericanfreedom.com, what we really tried to do, and we'd love feedback if you think we failed in any of this, but we really tried to write it and craft it in just normal, like, regular American English. Because I think what we fail at sometimes in Washington is speaking in acronyms and fancy terms and law numbers and bill numbers. Who connects with that, right? Who understands that? No normal person would. So we tried to write it so that any person, whether you're in or out of politics, whether you're new to these issues or you've been working on them for 20 years in your mind or in your family or your community, you could use, read, absorb, and process, and frankly, even repeat a lot of these items in the freedom agenda in your work, in your communications, in your family, your friends, that kind of thing. So hopefully it's a usable document, not just some, you know, Washington stuff that nobody understands.
Yeah, so well said, Paul Teller. And I could not agree more that we just need to take the bulldozer. And I'm loving seeing Trump doing that with a lot of his executive orders. I hope that Congress will be the same way. This is why also the midterms matter, that hopefully we'll gain more in the Senate so we can do more of that eradication. It shouldn't just be this kind of 20-year plan. I totally agree. We got to just basically nuke and destroy all of the false ideology that has been so persistent. You got to root out the poison. You can't just say, well, you know, we'll let it kind of thrive and survive even just a little bit, because then it'll come back with a vengeance. So more with Paul Teller on demand on Friday. Always appreciate his time so much. Go follow him on X at P Teller. And you can always reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.